the Whaling Commission credit card for her own purchases of groceries, meals, airline tickets, cash advances, retail items.
A former Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission executive director is charged with embezzling funds. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans debate adding more wilderness area to ANWR.
What we're talking about is locking up the largest potential resource in the country forever.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
The former executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission has been charged with embezzling nearly $500,000 from the organization. Maggie Amawak was executive director of AEWC from 1990 until 2007. According to the indictment released today, she began stealing from the organization in 2004. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ani Stewart says she stole the money in multiple ways.
Paying herself bonuses, taking payroll advances that were never repaid, issuing herself checks to herself as well as checks to cash that then she then deposited in her own account. Several of the large dollar transactions occurred while she was with a family member on gambling excursions. And she used the Whaling Commission credit card for her own purchases of groceries, meals, airline tickets, cash advances, retail items, paying her utility bills, all for herself and the benefit of her family members.
In June, another former executive director of AEWC was also charged with stealing from the organization. Teresa Judkins, who took over the job after Maggie Amawak was terminated, was accused of using commission funds to buy a snow machine and take payroll advances she never repaid. A court date for that trial is set for March of next year. Stewart says the Department of Justice learned of the thefts from AEWC.
The organization itself wrote a letter to our office indicating that following her termination and the termination of Teresa Judkins, who was the executive director after Amawak, that they believed there were some serious problems.
Johnny Aiken is the current executive director of AEWC. He confirms that staff within the organization contacted federal authorities about financial concerns within AEWC. He's been in the position since April of 2010.
Pretty sad day for community in AEWC. Hearing this news, I just learned of this about an hour and a half ago. And I just want to make it clear that this news does not reflect who we are as an organization or as a community.
Aiken says both past directors are respected longtime community members. Aiken says AEWC commissioners brought in new staff after problems surfaced at the organization, and he says all staff have cooperated fully with the federal investigation. He says they now have an independent accounting company.
And auditors to guide us in setting up an accounting and financial reporting system that guarantees that this kind of abuse, if there was abuse, can never happen again in the future.
The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission is a nonprofit formed in 1976 to protect subsistence whaling of bowhead whales. It receives hundreds of thousands of dollars in funding each year from the Department of Commerce. It also receives funding from the North Slope Borough. This year, that amount was $750,000. Borough Mayor Edward Itta wanted the organization to strengthen their accounting and auditing practices, as well as stabilize staffing. If convicted of stealing from the organization, Amawak faces a maximum prison sentence of 20 years and a fine of $250,000, plus restitution for the stolen funds. Maggie Amawak's husband, George, is running for mayor of the North Slope Borough. A federal agency is planning to evaluate the annual quota of bowhead whales that Alaska Natives can harvest for subsistence. The environmental review planned by NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service would cover the years 2013 through 17. The last environmental review done to support the quota level was done in 2008 and covered 2008 through 12. A draft of the new plan is expected in April. A public scoping period will run through October. In a release, NOAA says its goal is to recognize cultural and subsistence needs of Alaska Natives to the fullest extent possible, while also ensuring that any subsistence hunting doesn't adversely affect the conservation of the whale stock. It says Native subsistence hunters from 11 northern Alaska communities take less than 1% of the bowhead whale stock each year. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is stretching out its planning process for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The public comment period for its draft comprehensive conservation plan was extended to mid-November, pushing the final decision to late next year, probably after the 2012 election. Yesterday, 6 hours were set aside for a hearing in Anchorage. The reason for all this time is easy to see. The feds have proposed a wilderness recommendation for the coastal plain for the first time ever. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The lines of argument about the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge have been familiar since long before the Alaska Lands Act of 1980 was passed. Congress could not decide whether to allow oil and gas drilling there and punted that decision to some indefinite future date in the Act Section 1002. Repeatedly, swords have been crossed in Congress over the issue, but the stalemate has remained. In all those years since 1980, no administration has been willing to consider wilderness for the coastal plain. Fish and Wildlife never mentioned it when it began the planning process, but the oil industry and its supporters saw red flags anyway, and both sides were soon involved in campaigns to generate tens of thousands of comments. State Representative Craig Johnson, a Republican from Anchorage, was one of a number of Alaska officials who came to the meeting to tell the feds he thought they were way out of bounds on this one.
In the statehood compact, Alaska was promised a right to develop its own resources, and if that promise has ever been kept, it continues to be broken with ever-creeping federalism. The 1002 carve-out was set aside for resource development. And one thing I do want to point out now, that we're not here today to talk about drilling in Anwar. Our 1002 area. What we're talking about is locking up the largest potential resource in the country forever.
State Oil and Gas Division Director Bill Barron pointed to the Alaska Lands Act's no more wilderness language. Many told the Fish and Wildlife Service that with the high cost of fuel and the nation's stagnant economy, if nothing else, this was the wrong time to make such a decision. From the Arctic itself, Gwich'in Athabascans from Arctic Village, Vinatai, and Fort Yukon sent a multi-generational parade of witnesses before the hearing to endorse wilderness protection for the coastal plain, in part because of concern about the transboundary porcupine caribou herd. The Gwich'in served some caribou stew as they warmed up with what they called a cultural celebration prior to the hearing. From the village of Old Crow in the Yukon Territory, Vuntut Gwich'in Deputy Chief Lorraine Nitro added her voice.
In my community, we find it very, very important to be here today to bring this message to you.
As in Alaska, the Canadian village depends greatly on caribou, who go to the coastal plain to avoid predators when it's calving time. And Kay Wallace, a former Democratic state legislator from the interior, reminded the wildlife managers that the caribou are not alone in choosing that area to reproduce.
Please let us not disturb what nature has perfected. Let's continue to give wildlife a place to birth.
But others pointed to the succession of public opinion polls that have always shown Alaskans supporting drilling in Anwar. All the state's governors and every legislature has endorsed it. And State Oil and Gas Division Director Bill Barron scornfully pointed out that the feds did not even include a drilling alternative among the seven it presented.
There is a potential of massive amounts of oil and opportunity for our struggling economy. A very small production footprint and an excellent record of environmental responsibility. Yet despite these facts, the draft CCP and EIS for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge fails to even consider an alternative that includes resource development. Instead, the draft plan would ensure Alaskans and the nation resources remain locked in the ground. This is an egregious mistake, and Alaska takes strong exception to it.
The idea of the land managers actually suggesting drilling brought a heated response from Pamela Miller, a longtime ANWR activist. She said that is the business of Congress, and the business of the Fish and Wildlife Service is to look at what is best for the fish and wildlife.
While the decision is in the hands of Congress, this decision is in the hands of the Fish and Wildlife Service to correct the record, to set aside a recommendation for the coastal plain of as wilderness, and also to complete its wilderness review for the whole refuge. It is a remarkable document. It was time it was done, and I thank you for this opportunity to comment.
The last hearing is set for Fairbanks next month during AFN week. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the legacy of Athabascan Elder Hannah Solomon.
Taking care of the land, the resources, keeping our culture strong in terms of our language.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
The Army is reporting the death of another Fort Wainwright-based soldier in Afghanistan, the second this week. U.S. Army Alaska officials say Sergeant Timothy Douglas Sane of Reno, Nevada, was killed Sunday by a roadside bomb in Kandahar Province. The 31-year-old Sane was a cavalry scout assigned with the Fairbanks-based 1st Striker Brigade combat team. Next of kin have been notified. The death follows that of fellow Striker Specialist Ryan J. Cook of Florida, who died of injuries suffered in a separate IED attack, also Sunday in Kandahar Province. The soldiers are the 14th and 15th Fort Wainwright-based troops to be killed in Afghanistan since the brigade's current year-long deployment began in April. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has accumulated a list of 6 engineering and development groups willing to consider designing and managing the project if it proceeds. The Statement of Qualifications, or SOQ, from the companies will be used to make a final decision on the authority's private partner. The authority has also begun appraisals for the right-of-way into the Government Hill area of Anchorage. However, residents in the path of the more than $3 billion project say there's no money yet for the job, and the authority is getting ahead of itself. Bob French is president of the Government Hill Community Council.
Kubota doesn't have any of the finances finalized. They don't have any permits. They haven't gone beyond a 35% design. And, you know, they're just now getting authorization to spend $15 million of state and federal money to start acquiring properties. Now, that's putting the cart way before the horse.
The authority's board chairman, Mike Foster, says Kubota is on schedule, right where it needs to be, both in the design management phase and with getting its right-of-way. He says the green light comes from the Federal Highway Administration.
Everything we're doing is right on schedule, right on line with the standard process. I mean, the Federal Highways would not be letting us get out ahead of ourselves unless they were comfortable in where we're at. So we are not jumping the gun by doing right-of-way, and we're not jumping the gun by doing the SOQ and stuff. I mean, we are right on our schedule for, you know, a late 2013 or 2014 construction window.
Foster says the state will offer design awards to 3 of the 6 companies now on the list. Each will receive a $2 million grant for a detailed project proposal. He says the state will own the company's work. The freshwater lake seals that apparently make their home in Lake Iliamna are the subject of an ongoing scientific project that was outlined in some detail during last week's 27th annual Lowell Wakefield Fisheries Symposium in Anchorage. KDLG's Mike Mason was there and has this story.
The one thing that was made perfectly clear during last week's presentation about the Illiamna Lake seals was just how much is not known about the seals, their movements, and their life history. The presentation was made by Jennifer Burns with the University of Alaska Anchorage's Department of Biology. She pointed out that Lake Illiamna is the largest lake in Alaska, and the seals in the lake are just the fifth known population of freshwater lake seals on Earth.
We do know that the seals have been in the lake for a long time, but we don't have very good information on the numbers or their abundance, and we don't have very good information on whether that abundance changes seasonally, as we might expect it to do, because the lake is frozen for 7 months out of the year.
The intent of the ongoing research project, which also includes the National Marine Mammal Laboratory and the Bristol Bay Native Association, is to integrate local traditional knowledge and data about subsistence use of the seals with aerial surveys to improve the understanding of the Illiamna Lake seals. Burns confirms that the seals are an important yet fairly small part of the subsistence diets of residents in the Illiamna Lake area. However, the scientific research project was sparked by the request for more information about the seals from leaders in several lake communities, including Leavelock, Kakanak, Illiamna, and Pedro Bay. Burns confirms that one aspect of the ongoing project is household surveys about the seals and how they're used for subsistence.
Clearly, the use of the freshwater seals is important because we had lots of comments about how that was a special activity and how seals that they harvested in the lake were different in condition and softness, their fat was different than the seals that they took in Bristol Bay area.
During her presentation, Burns pointed out that scientists don't know many of the important details about the migration patterns or life history of the freshwater seals that are found in Illiamna Lake. However, she stressed that through the surveys and interviews, some important aspects of the seals' behavior have been identified.
We learned from the community members that there were always seals in the lake. Some suggestion that there was at least as many and perhaps more seals in the lake now. Locals reported seeing seals targeting fish in the salmon, particularly in the New Halen River and even in the Kvitchak River, where they hadn't noticed seals in the past. And some idea that maybe the seals were moving back and forth between Bristol Bay and Illiamna Lake, perhaps in response to activities in the larger area. So this is all information that was captured from the locals, not information that was in any way known to management biologists before this work.
Burns confirmed that the aerial surveys of the lake will continue and will even be expanded this year and next year. She also noted that the project to gather subsistence use data and other local knowledge of the lake seals will also continue this year and next year. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years. And by AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A former lumber mill owner from Washington State says he's again considering building a new plant in Wrangell or Petersburg. John Glenn has ties to Petersburg, and he's proposed building a mill in the community in the past. His latest plan includes a facility that would manufacture construction-grade lumber and employ 40 to 50 people using a combination of old-growth and second-growth timber. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
John Glenn told the committee he was looking at building a full manufacturing facility, either in Petersburg or Wrangell.
And a full manufacturing facility is a facility that will take the timber from the log form through kill drying process, planing process, grade stamping, and then will be shipped to points around the world.
Glenn said the dry kilns would be fired by wood waste burners that meet clean air standards. He said the mill would take a year to build and would then employ 40 to 50 full-time workers.
The biggest challenge that we have in front of us is land to put it on, because we need to have water access so that we bring a chip barge in to be able to load the chips, and then also either bring a barge in to take our containers to Prince Rupert, or if we use a local barging company,
than, you know, we could transport into town.
Glenn went to high school in Petersburg, where his father ran Mitkoff Lumber in the 1970s. He eventually started his own business, Glenn Custom Milling in Shelton, Washington, which he sold in 2004. He's proposed building a facility in Southeast before. Most recently, in 2004, he considered buying the site of the former mill in Wrangell, but it didn't pan out. At the time, Glenn said he was also looking at Petersburg as a potential location. Glenn told the committee he was again looking at the old mill site in Wrangell, but he was also again willing to consider Petersburg and wanted to see what the town could offer.
I don't like to have all my eggs in one basket, and I'd like for the city of Petersburg and the people of Petersburg to take a look at what options that we have here.
Glenn said the facility would consume 8 to 10 million board feet of timber per season. That's roughly a third of the annual timber volume that's been cut on the Tongass National Forest in the past few years. But Glenn said that between state and federal offerings, he thought there would be enough wood available to meet his needs. He pointed out that the industry currently exports raw logs from Southeast.
If they can export round logs, then they surely can provide the timber that we need for this facility. Okay, why do we want to export?
Glenn said he'd like 20 to 30% of his wood supply to come from second growth timber, newer trees that could be cut or thinned from areas which were logged many decades before. A couple of people in the audience question whether there would really be enough wood to support a mill like the one Glenn described, while also supplying smaller mills and maintaining protections for fish and wildlife. Petersburg's Eric Lee said the timber inventory was just not there, considering the decades it takes for second growth timber to reach marketable size.
It's always been the hope here in Petersburg, and Wrangell too, that there would be small operators, and a small operators industry that would be sustainable. And I think that we would lose that if another substantial mill came in.
A small mill operator from Petersburg, Jared Cook, said he was not sure how Glenn's proposed facility would affect his business, but he wished him luck.
Looking at the bigger picture, from my aspect, having grown up here and lived here, is someone who's going to employ that many people in this community is more important than what it's going to do to my small one, two-man sawmill.
Cook expected that more second growth from the area would eventually be logged, and he said the bottom line was whether it would go to a mill in Petersburg or somewhere else. Finance committee members and other local officials expressed support for Glenn's proposal and offered help in researching sites in Petersburg. I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
A memorial service and potlatch are happening in Fairbanks today to honor Hannah Solomon, the Athabascan elder who grew up in the bush and went on to promote and preserve Alaska Native culture and traditions, died last week at the age of 102. KUAC's Tim Ellis has this remembrance.
Hannah Solomon's long life in many ways reflects the experience of Alaska Natives over the past century or so, a time of transition for Indigenous people in this part of the world who've had to adapt to the new world they've been thrust into. That narrative helps define Hannah's life and legacy, that is, her strongly held belief that Alaska Natives must never forget the ancient ways learned from living in this land for thousands of years, that Native culture and customs are integral to Indigenous peoples' identity, and that it's essential for them to hold on to that identity in a Western culture that can and has overwhelmed Native culture. Hannah's daughter, Daisy, says her mother passed along her considerable knowledge of Gwich'in Athabascan traditions to many people, beginning with her and her 13 brothers and sisters.
She's passed on a lot of traditional and cultural ways in her life. She's done that to many of us, her grandkids and her great-grandkids and her great-great-grandkids.
Besides her 14 children, Hannah raised four kids born to Paul, her husband of 46 years, along with many foster children. Daisy took a few minutes out of her very busy day on Wednesday to talk with a visitor about her mom as friends and relatives shuffled in for a lunch that featured an entree of moose heart. Daisy says she thinks her mom's long life may be at least partly due to her strong faith. She was a devout, lifelong Episcopalian. Daisy says it could also be because her mother stayed away from alcohol and because of the rigorous life that she lived in her younger years in the bush.
Well, my mom lived a very healthy life because, I mean, she never drank a drop of alcohol in her life.
Oh, gosh.
And she was out doing subsistence living.
Steve Guinness is a lifelong friend of Hannah, who grew up in Fort Yukon with the family, and he's also the executive director of the Fairbanks Native Association. Guinness says he believes Hannah's life in Fort Yukon and in the bush shaped her belief in the importance of preserving and passing on Native culture and traditions.
One of the things that she installed in all of us was to be proud of who we are and to love and respect each other and to continue to do what we can to preserve the legacy of elders from the past. You know, taking care of the land, the resources, keeping our culture strong in terms of our language, the different dances we do and things of that nature.
Hannah was born in 1908 in Old Rampart, a village on the Porcupine River near the Canadian border. She was raised by her adoptive parents in the Yukon Flats, learning traditions of the Gwich'in Athabascans there, including beadworking from her mother, Eliza. Hannah lived for many years in Fort Yukon and helped the town incorporate, and later served as its first woman mayor. She brought her love of community and Native culture to Fairbanks when she and Paul moved here in the 1960s. Friends and family say Hannah often visited Fort Yukon and longed for the simpler life there. She said that in a 1991 interview with other elders, in which she recalled a rough winter that she and her family endured in Fairbanks long ago.
In 1942, when we lived in Fairbanks, I did a lot of sewing at that time too, because I was home with the kids all the time. We stayed in Fairbanks only 1 year that winter. It was so hard that we had to move back to Fort Yukon, because the kids go to school, they pick up all kind of sickness, whatever. And they just kept me so busy with the hospital that winter.
Okay.
It was, the life in the village was nice and clean.
Hannah will return to Fort Yukon on Saturday, where she'll be laid to rest next to her beloved husband, Paul. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.